From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a hospital as doctors performed an emergency C-section on a 23-year-old woman. The woman, Amy, had arrived at the hospital complaining of a headache. Up until that point, her pregnancy had been relatively normal, no complications. But when Amy arrived that day, she suddenly collapsed and lost consciousness. Doctors scrambled to save her baby daughter while doing the best to keep Amy alive. After the procedure, Amy's daughter survived, but she did not. She suffered a massive stroke, one that had been preventable. It was related to severe high blood pressure. What happened to Amy happens about twice a day in the United States. Our country has the worst rate of maternal mortality in the developed world, and it's the only country where those rates are increasing, getting worse. About 700 American women die each year as a result of complications related to pregnancy or delivery. And that begs the question, with the resources and quality of care available in the United States, why are these rates so high? New York State ranks 30th in the nation. We're in the lower half when it comes to quality of maternal mortality rate. And now Governor Cuomo has announced statewide efforts to protect mothers, lower the mortality rate, and provide more care for mothers who experience depression. We'll talk about those efforts this hour, as well as why the United States has such high rates of maternal mortality and depression. I'd like to welcome our guest. Dr. Chris Glantz is professor of obstetrics and gynecology in the Division of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center and member of New York State's Maternal Mortality Review Board. Dr. Glantz, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also here is Dr. Jennifer Richman, assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Richman, welcome to you.
Thanks.
Also here is Lauren Deutsch, who's an executive director of the Healthy Baby Network. Lauren, welcome to you.
Thanks so much.
And also here is Heather Bryan, a local mom and a former patient of Dr. Glantz, who experienced complications with her pregnancy. Heather, welcome. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How are you doing these days?
Wonderful.
Yeah?
Yes.
Well, there's a lot to talk about here and a lot of different directions we could go with this. And I'm just going to kind of go around the table and start with Dr. Glantz on this. When it comes to these numbers, unfortunately, they're surprising to some, but maybe less surprising to others who have a general view of our healthcare system as one with that should have a lot of resources in a country with a lot of wealth, but then questions on why a number of our healthcare stats aren't in the top one or two or three or five. How do you view this particular issue?
Well, it's not an issue that's easily resolved. I think there are several ways of looking at it. We have enormous wealth. Of course, there's also an enormous inequality of that wealth and distribution. We're also a very homogeneous society, and not everyone has access to the same care, not everyone has the same underlying health problems, and not everyone has the same health insurance, basically. So I think right off the bat, we have a great racial disparity. Women of color are 3 to 4 times more likely to be subject to maternal death, even when you take into account things like education and insurance. We're really not sure why that is. Hispanics, interestingly, that's not the case. So we have some more work to do to try to solve that. I think as far as the insurance, certainly there's been a lot of politics around that. What system would be the best? Obviously, a system where everyone had insurance would be preferable because that does drive care. Another possibility is that maybe we're just better at tracking maternal deaths. It sounds straightforward enough. One is either alive or dead. But trying to figure out in a given death, was the patient pregnant? If she was currently pregnant, that's pretty straightforward. But maternal deaths also go out for 42 days or even as long as a year. It's not always clear from the death certificates, which is where a lot of the data comes from, whether pregnancy was really involved, and if it was, to what degree. So part of this may actually just be that we track it more effectively. Another problem has been that over the years, obesity has become more of a problem, and that's related to hypertension and diabetes and some other untoward outcomes that put these women at higher risk. The age at which women are getting pregnant also has gone up considerably, and a disproportionate amount of the deaths do occur in the women 35 years and above compared to their roughly 15% pregnancies, about 25% of deaths. And this may also be related to increased medical problems. I would have to say one other thing. I think a lot of women have a lot of faith in medicine, which is good. But on the other hand, a lot of women who maybe wouldn't have gotten pregnant in the past because of various medical problems, the degree of diabetes or hypertension, they've had transplants, mm-hmm. they've had strokes, they've had, you know, cardiac disease, now are thinking, well, the doctors are great. They'll get me through this. And usually we do, but not always. And if more and more of these women are getting pregnant, some degree they're pushing the envelope and it just doesn't always work out the way they hoped.
All right. So I know it's a complicated picture, and too often maybe those people like me in the media try to sort of distill it too much. But I'm wondering if it does trouble you, if the numbers do trouble you, and if you do view any singular first step that might at least start changing some of these numbers.
They definitely trouble me. I think that, as you said, our country should be a leader, not near the end. New York State is number 30 in the most recent rankings. That's not where we want to be. On the other hand, we used to be worse. We were number 47 out of 50 before. So we are making progress. We've, through the American College of OBGYN and now more recently also through the Department of Health in Albany, we've been working on some initiatives to try to address some of the more preventable causes of maternal deaths. And I think we are seeing some more awareness and perhaps the beginnings of progress in that regard.
All right. And listeners, I don't want to scare anybody. I mean, that's not the point here. But the point is also to look at if we have a metric of health that's not getting better in a country like this, why is that happening? So that's part of why we're here. And Lauren Deutsch, why don't you tell us what the Healthy Baby Network is and how you view this issue?
Yeah, the Healthy Baby Network is a local nonprofit. We do maternal child health, care connection, advocacy, and really convening. We're the local champions for healthy babies. We look at issues that affect the community. We look at systems delivery, and we try to figure out, how can we do better? So that's us. We've been around for about 20 years. We are the Healthy Start Rochester grantee. We do home visitation. We do health education. We do outreach. And I will say this issue has been on our minds a lot. I think that there are a few layers that I want to tease out from what Dr. Glantz was sharing. One is that when women come to the hospital to deliver and they experience complications, often the first symptom that they experience is pain or bleeding. Most women experience pain and bleeding as part of a healthy delivery. So the difference is that when patients ask for extra help, they say, hey, this isn't normal, they need to be believed. The issue of how much pain is too much pain, how much blood is too much blood, is something that I think that nursing staff and hospital staff aren't always as sensitive to as the patient. And for women who are not used to being believed or concerned that they won't believed, and this goes back to the disparate outcomes for women of color, that there's a real difficulty there when patients feel disenfranchised, when they feel that their voice is not being heard or not being listened to. Often by the time people realize that this is a serious symptom that's going on, it may be too late. So those are really some of the concerns that the mothers that we serve have when they go in for medical care. Now, we haven't had a maternal death with the mothers that we serve in a while. We have, unfortunately, had some infant deaths. And we've had a lot of women have really negative and traumatizing birth experiences where they felt like they weren't listened to by their provider, where they felt like they said, hey, I'm in pain. Hey, I have a problem here. Hey, I'm concerned. And everyone said, oh, it's kind of normal. Well, we'll check back in an hour. So this is some of the narrative that we want to shift. The other thing that I want to tease out is hypertension. So nationally, the biggest driver of infant mortality is genetic. Locally, it's actually prematurity. And the biggest single driver of prematurity is hypertension. That's either pregnancy-related hypertension or pre-pregnancy hypertension that's exacerbated by the pregnancy. Now, historically, we think of hypertension as sort of an old white man's disease. And the medications that are marketed for hypertension are marketed that way. And the people who think about hypertension as a risk are older white men. It's not true anymore. Young women, childbearing age women, and young women of color particularly are at great risk for hypertension, are experiencing hypertension at clinical levels, and it's affecting their pregnancies. It's the biggest single driver of prematurity, which it's in turn is the biggest single driver locally of infant mortality. So thinking about, or rather rethinking, who the patient is, what are they experiencing, and really listening to their voices, I think could make a huge shift in the outcomes that we're seeing.
All right, so there's a couple of things that I want to follow up on, and then we're going to turn to some of our other guests, not only for their experiences, but with the fact that with the governor coming out and talking about not only maternal mortality, but also depression, kind of coupling these things together, there are some related things here. But before we do that, I want to follow up directly on some of what Lauren Deutsch talked about with pain. Because one thing I learned now as a dad is that, first of all, women moms are amazing. I mean, and the amount of pain tolerance, let's be honest here, If it was up to us guys, we'd have a generation or two and it'd probably be over. just that would be the end. I am amazed, and I don't mean to be flippant about that. I'm being honest about this. I am amazed at what the human body can do, what happens. And so I think, Dr. Glantz, when it comes to pain, and I'll ask both of you to follow up on this, it's really complex. When you talk to new moms, the day after giving birth, if they're asked, what's your pain on a scale of 0 to 10, one of the first questions is, do you mean before in my life pre-labor or like now? Because it's a different scale. And what seemed painful before seems like nothing when you deal, especially if you do meds free. You know, imagine, and that is something that is admirable, and a lot of women are doing that. And so when it comes to pain, I hear Lauren saying the concern is some moms are not being heard. I wonder if doctors feel like it's complex. We want to listen, but some pain is normal. You know, that this is not a pain-free experience. How do we distinguish when it's different, particularly for first-time moms? You know, that's not an easy kind of equation. And I don't mean to be an apologist. I'm trying to just sort through a complex situation.
Well, Lauren can correct me if I'm wrong. I believe what she may be referring to not so much is labor pain, but other pains that go along. In this case, maybe perhaps the patient had a terrible headache from her hypertension, mm-hmm. and that led to the stroke. There are a lot of aches and pains that go along with pregnancy that in most cases are normal, but unfortunately, sometimes they're the same degree of aches and pains that go along with conditions that aren't normal. When you've done obstetrics for a number of years, there's a tendency to say, oh, well, that's pretty much the miseries of pregnancy or whatever. And usually it is. But I think clinically, one of our goals is we need to be able to discern, well, when is this a little bit more than just the normal stuff? Send them for further testing. Make sure something else isn't going on. I think labor pain is a whole nother issue.
Yeah, I wouldn't conflate labor pain with pain associated with other complications. It can be very difficult to tell when they're occurring at the same time. But there's really good reason to say, you know, listen to the patient. How concerned are they? And that may not be 100% accurate. On the other hand, if you have a patient who's complaining, you say, yeah, you're fine. And then they either have a bad outcome or felt that they were ignored and not well cared for during their whole experience, you've impacted not only their income, their outcome for this particular care interaction, but their sort of subsequent experience of going to a doctor. Will I be listened to? Are they going to take good care of me? So I really think there is a lot of, especially in obstetrics and gynecology, where this is a really vulnerable time in someone's life, and there's an opportunity to do great good or make it very, very traumatic. It's an important time to be following up, asking about symptoms like pain, asking about bleeding, how much is normal, what do you usually experience? And, you know, and particularly, I guess my background, I was a domestic violence attorney before my current position. And one of the things I encountered is even in the medical establishment, the perceptions of who feels how much pain and what pain is important, what pain is worthy of our attention. There's a racial element to it. There's a systemic element to how much we believe what women self-report. And it's important to really be thinking about those lenses and how they may be operating for the physician, but also for the patient when they have the courage to speak up and say, hey, I'm in pain, especially if you've been socialized to pretend you're not or say it's not really a big deal. So really thinking about how all those biases interact when a patient is seeking care.
Let me ask Heather Bryant, a mother who I think is a former patient of Dr. Glantz. So
yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience?
I had a wonderful experience with Dr. Glantz. I was very fortunate. In fact, it's about 8 years ago, March, I met him. I did have a good outcome. I think I should jump right to that. I was very fortunate. Mm-hmm. Just from the beginning of the pregnancy, it was up and down, cautiously optimistic, et cetera. The fetus didn't grow, and then it did. And then a month later, we had our first ultrasound in March of 10, and there was an umbilical cord cyst, or I didn't know what that was. It was a big balloon on the ultrasound.
A really big balloon.
A really big balloon. And we find out 1% of all pregnancies are some small number, and we're lucky. So that was where the horror, if you will, started, because we didn't know at 20 weeks if we would have to, you know, terminate the pregnancy, if we would lose the baby. We didn't know anything, and it was just horrible. And that's when Dr. Glantz literally walked into the room and into our lives. And here we are, you know, It was just, I was very fortunate with the care. Everybody listened to me. I physically, thankfully, didn't have any issues. It was all internal, which I guess, you know, it was a blessing because I can't imagine. I did, to your point, at one time you said something about depression. There was those 2 weeks after I had the amniocentesis that I don't know if I've ever been depressed, but those 2 weeks were the worst weeks of my life. I didn't want to talk to anybody, though. My poor husband, I did talk to my mom. I didn't want to talk to friends. I didn't want to email anybody. I didn't want to do anything. So, you know, did I know that there were people out there to talk to me? Yes. Did I want to talk to them? No. And maybe that was shame on me. But you don't know what to do because you don't know what the outcome's going to be. Fortunately, we found out we didn't have any terminal issues with the fetus at the time. So I started to come out of my shell. And then that's when I turned to people and said, okay, I need support. I need prayers. Let's rally and let's get this baby to term. You know, and at 23 weeks, we were ready to deliver. But she made it to 38 weeks.
Wow. And was the risk to the baby only, or was there any risk to the mother in this case?
In this particular case, the primary risks were to Heather. The baby had the defect, she said. We kept, unfortunately, finding others.
More. Yeah.
And that just added more weight to the concern that is this a baby that's going to survive? The growth was trailing off. So the risk was mostly to the fetus at this point.
Okay. And obviously, you know, they're here telling the story that had an outcome that was on, I don't know how else to describe it, on the really good end of the scale of possible outcomes here.
Yes.
But you also are describing yourself as someone who maybe went through a few weeks where you not only were depressed, but you know, maybe you had a lot of questions. You don't know. I don't want to overgeneralize, but I do want to ask if you feel like, should we be concerned about moms who either don't want to ask questions or don't feel like they should describe pain? You know, the concern that I'm hearing here is, you know, are we getting good information? Are doctors responding appropriately when there is pain? There's also a culture of toughness. I mean, childbirth is beautiful, but it's also tough, and there's some pain. And, you know, women are amazing. But there's this idea that can they describe something that may be going wrong? How did you feel about that?
I felt that in terms of pain, I felt very comfortable with both Dr. Glantz and my other doctor, my regular OBGYN, talking to both of them all the time. I think the problem that I had, and we asked a lot of questions. The problem that I had is we didn't have answers, and that was not anybody's. It was just you don't know. We didn't know what was wrong. We didn't know why it happened. I felt comfortable asking, and I kept asking and asking, as Dr. Glantz can confirm. I think some people might not, in all fairness too, some questions I didn't want to ask because I didn't want to know the answers. So maybe some, you know, women out there are afraid to know, you know, what's going to happen to my baby. I don't want to know. So if I don't ask it, then maybe if it's a bad answer, I won't hear it. I don't want to know. If you're going to tell me we have to terminate this pregnancy, I don't want to hear it. But I felt comfortable. I didn't have physical pain. So I was fortunate with not having to address that. You know, I was on bed rest for months. So, but that's not pain.
Okay. So you want to add a little bit to that, Dr. Glantz?
Well, I think Heather was remarkably resilient because for a while, every time she came in, it seemed like something else had gone wrong. But she stuck it out, and then things stabilized, and we were actually able to monitor the fetus very carefully and get her to within a couple weeks of her due date. And she went and had a nice induced labor, as
yes.
it turns out,
yes.
because the baby was so small. But everything turned out quite well in the end.
Yes.
You can fill
Very
in any
true.
Details there.
Yes. Well, and I do have to say the childbirth is not pleasant. She did let me only push her once, and she came out. So I said, I deserve that after these past 9 months of the upside down, the roller coaster we had.
But the advantage of a small baby.
That's true, too.
I want to talk also about maternal depression in a moment. It affects, according to the governor's office, as many as 1 in 7 mothers nationally. Before we do that, though, let's grab a phone call, and this is Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, thank you. I have a general question. It seems to me that one of the big problems we have with our medical system in the United States is people need to go when their health, why their health before they get sick. So is that a problem? I mean, it seems to me that women are finding out they're pregnant when in fact they should have been going to school or going to the doctor decades before they got pregnant. So is that a problem that we're just not giving enough pre-health care to people, and this is where the problem is coming from? Thanks very much.
All right, Bernard, thank you.
Oh, I can certainly address that. My field is high-risk obstetrics, and so we are delighted when women with known medical problems come in before they're pregnant, whether it's high blood pressure, whether it's diabetes, whether it's lupus, whatever the problem is, because then we can try to help them optimize their health before they get pregnant, or in some cases, perhaps make sure they realize what they're undertaking and the risk to themselves if they do. Unfortunately, this rarely is the case. We usually get women at 8, 12, 15 weeks. It's a done deal at that point, and now we have to try to make up for lost time. So this would definitely be very helpful if people would start the process before they get pregnant.
I want to echo that, too, for mental health issues, too. If people, it's often most people are unplanned pregnancies in general, but with mental health issues also. So we love when someone says, I want to have a baby, let's look at my mental health, let's look at my medication, let's see how we can optimize everything beforehand. And that happens sometimes, but most of the time it's after the fact.
All right, so
I'd like to add, if I may. A lot of the sort of health outcomes don't happen at the doctor's office, too. So when we talk about preventative health care, we also need to be thinking about education, stable housing, food deserts, all of the sort of social determinants of health that really influence health factors. For a lot of the moms we work with, most of their risk factors have already predetermined their level of risk by the time they get pregnant. So, planning a pregnancy, as Jen mentioned, we have a really high rate of unintended pregnancy locally. In the city of Rochester, it's close to 50%. But so the ability to plan your pregnancy, have access to the education and resources to do that, have the stability in your life to have a healthy pregnancy, all of those things need to be addressed, not just at the doctor's office. They need to be addressed at every level in order to have those sort of preventative health and well-being setups that create positive outcomes.
All right. So as we talk about mother's health, maternal mortality, and depression, particularly after women give birth, what we're talking about is part of the reason we're here is the governor's office rolled out essentially a two-point plan. And so here's what the governor is talking about doing. Number one, the governor is going to direct the Department of Financial Services to require all health insurance policies include coverage for maternal depression screening and launch a new maternal mortality review board. The governor and the lieutenant governor's office saying that 30th in the nation for maternal mortality, despite an improvement in recent years, not nearly good enough, and they want to learn more about essentially what's happening and try to learn from that. So those are two directives from the governor's office. And listeners, if you want to share your experiences, we would certainly be willing to hear from you. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Dr. Jennifer Richmond is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Does it make sense to you to put these two ideas together, maternal mortality and then depression?
I mean, we were just talking about that before we got in here because we were trying to link them. I mean, it's a very broad topic, but I think in general, most people have postpartum depression. We're definitely depressed during pregnancy, and there's an overall feeling of fear when it comes to treating that, even referring to therapy, and even from the women, right? I mean, back in a while ago, we used to think that pregnancy was protective. I'm air quoting here, but was protective, and that everyone walked on clouds and was so happy. We know that's, I mean, anyone who's had a baby or lived with someone who was pregnant knows that's not true. But there is that toughness. There's sort of first time moms. There's a lot of guilt. I should be able to handle this. I shouldn't treat this. So really, we want to start earlier, identify this, in pregnancy. Women who are depressed, they don't get care. So there's all the social determinants, like I can't, we work in a clinic that tends to deal with a very low socioeconomic status population. And, they can't get into their appointment because they don't have childcare. They don't have transportation. So they're dealing with that, but then also dealing with providers who are sort of scared of asking the questions and then treating it. And we know if we treat depression during pregnancy, we're hopefully, the thought is that we'll be able to prevent postpartum depression. I think we do a better job at screening for postpartum depression than we do for depression during pregnancy. So there's definitely a lot of work, but they're not allowed to, they don't, women who are depressed, they don't take care of themselves as well. They don't have adequate nutrition. They don't tend to go to the provider. They miss more work. So there's lots of issues with that, which could increase later on the decreased care, mortality, and things like that. So
Dr. Richmond, forgive my ignorance on that, and I want to be careful not to sort of speak about it. I'm not the one with the expertise here, but in a lot of prior discussions on issues like mental health and depression, there is kind of a way of distinguishing between someone who has chemical ongoing depression in various forms versus people who have depressive episodes. And, you know, I'm thinking of moms I know who do not have chemical depression, but became moms and struggled with, why am I down? Why am I feeling this way? I don't have depression, you know, and this is a new feeling, and what do I do about this? And number one, is it covered if I want to get sort of care for this? And number two, is there something, you know, are there stigmas attached to needing care for that?
I don't separate like chemical depression from depression. Depression's a symptomatic diagnosis, right? We have this book, the DSM-5, and there's symptoms that you have to meet, and it's 2 weeks. So any 2 weeks, doesn't matter if you had it before, of, you know, anhedonia or decreased ability or want to do things, depressed mood, poor energy, poor sleep, poor appetite, sometimes suicidal thoughts. So yes, it can pop up when you've had a history and you've been stable during pregnancy, or it can happen postpartum. Most insurances will cover somewhat with the mental health parity law, but a lot of these women, have very high copays to get into mental health treatment. We don't have a lot of mental health providers, even in an area which has a lot of providers who are accepting new patients, who specialize in sort of maternal depression and postpartum depression. Postpartum depression tends to present a little bit differently than sort of, I'll call it, regular depression.
In what ways?
Not wanting to bond with the baby is probably one of the most common, that and or overly being involved. So there are some women who won't let their husbands hold the baby. They'll go check on a baby numerous times. A funny thing that we always ask people who are depressed is, are you sleeping? Obviously, with a new mom, you have to alter your questions. You know, you have to say, are you sleeping when the baby's sleeping? And if you're not, then why not? You have to delve a little deeper. Same thing with another common issue with postpartum depression is isolation, which can happen with regular depression, but usually when you give birth, right, you have this onslaught of family and friends, and a lot of people are loving, accepting help. So in women with postpartum depression, a lot of the times they sort of shy away. They don't want anyone to help. They keep isolated. So there's different things, you know, that you want to focus in on. That and also the number one thing that we want to ask is, are you having thoughts of harming the baby? Although not common, that can come with depression, and a lot of providers and people in general are afraid to ask about that. But that's, you know, a serious issue. And so that can lead us to postpartum psychosis and then, you know, sometimes infant death. So that's another thing that we want to ask more when we're thinking about postpartum depression.
Dr. Richmond, do you see the governor's proposal as at least expanding access to care?
As far as I know, it's screening, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the issue with screening, as with anything, is we can screen, but then what do we do with people once they screen positive? And I think, you know, the same issues are there with access. They have done some studies that show screening in itself can improve outcomes, I think because of just feeling like people are listened to. But I think it can help. I think there's a long, long way to go as far as, you know, a population sort of change based on just screening.
So is there something top of mind that if the governor's office called you tomorrow and said, all right, Dr. Richmond, so screening is one thing. What else can we do here?
Well, I think we need to have more education to providers. I'll speak for my own profession. Even psychiatrists, this is their expertise. Psychiatrists are afraid to give medications during pregnancy. They feel like, you know, they're going to be at risk, when actually not treating depression can also be risky. I think we need better education, better systems that can help these women continue care throughout pregnancy, because there's a shift, right? You start with your primary, who might know you well. If you have a family doc, you might be able to continue through the whole way. But then you switch to another doctor, an OB, and your psychiatrist is like, I don't feel comfortable with this. I'm going to just not prescribe to you. Let me have the OB prescribe. We were talking about this before. Then the OB's like, I don't prescribe these medications all the time. I don't know what to do. And there's sort of a hot potato that goes around. If there were other states, you know, have more perinatal clinic, we have a perinatal consultation clinic, but we don't follow people there. A bigger sort of network of people that feel more comfortable taking care of these women, because they often get abandoned, to be honest.
You're describing what sounds to me like fear of liability.
Yes. I don't know if you agree with
Dr. me. Dr. Glantz?
Yes. Unfortunately, I would agree that that is part of it. I think a lot of providers in obstetrics feel that they may be a little reluctant to screen because they're not sure what to do with the results when they get them. They don't feel expert, and they may not see the resources available in the community. There are only so many psychiatrists and other behavioral therapists. At the same time, the irony here is the people who know the most about these mental health drugs may be unwilling to prescribe them during pregnancy, whereas we, who might be willing to prescribe them, we don't know a lot about them. So wouldn't it really be better to get together and come to an agreement?
I'm going to get to your phone calls in a second. Ann, hang there. But this is, again, super probably overly simplifying question. But is there a list of medications that, let's say you have a patient who's pregnant, these medications are okay, these are only okay if X? No? There's not?
No.
Could there be?
No. So that's
what
I do, basically. We do consultations around medication. The problem is it's always a risk-benefit, right? And we don't talk about risk-benefit when we're treating diabetes or epilepsy, because everyone just agrees that it's a medical condition that needs to be treated. But with depression, and that's probably because of stigma, people think that women should just go along and be depressed and sort of suck it up, as I tell a lot of my patients, and that they'll be fine, when that's not really the case. So in general, you know, most of the medications that have been studied, serotonin, antidepressants, have a fairly good risk profile. We can never say something 100% is safe. And I always tell my women, if anyone tells you that, they're lying. But, you know, they have a fairly, you know, safe risk profile, but there are issues. And anytime, you know, something comes up, it sparks the sort of fear that any new mom has or any family member and even a psychiatrist. So there is no, we can't say that. It depends on the woman's severity of the depression, severity of past episodes, how they're functioning, and then the risk of the medication. We're always sort of balancing that out. And that's why each person is different.
I'd like to add to something that you said just a moment ago about asking women if they're having thoughts of harming their child, because I think a lot of the moms that we work with are scared to own up to something like that. They're scared their children will be taken away from them. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, as you mentioned, the stigma of admitting that you're depressed, but specifically thoughts of harming your child. I think it's actually statistically a really common thought that women who are experiencing postpartum depression have, but how scary it is to admit that and ask for help, and the fear of how you will be responded to. Or, you know, is that going to be a CPS call? Are your older children going to be taken from your care? So I think, as Dr. Richmond says, it's really important to think about the impact of stigma on care seeking and women asking for help and how providers are trained to respond to that.
Let me grab a phone call. This is Ann in Rochester. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And this question is for Dr. Glenn. I wonder if you could speak to the difference in the maternal, the M&M rate in the mid-80s and that now, 35 years later. I came from Long Beach Memorial with Roger Freeman and Tom Garrity, worked with him back then. We were appalled at the rate then, and now it looks like it's much higher. And could you also, is there a connection with the C-section rate?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. If you compare our current measured rates to the 80s, we're quite a bit higher, probably twice as high. New York State's overall rate is just a little bit above the national average, which is, again, an improvement. Like I said earlier in the show, the problem is we don't really have a good handle on why that is, whether it's just we're better able to track these, or whether it's sicker patients, whether obesity is part of the problem, whether income inequality and social issues and heterogeneity of the population is playing a role. Now, all of these things were present to some degree back in the 80s as well, but they do seem to have gotten worse in the last decade or two.
So, listeners, I'm way late for a break. I just looked up. I see it's 1:40. I thought it was 1:30. Anne in Pittsburgh. So another Anne on the line. I see the phone ringing again. I know a lot of people want to share their stories or ask questions about, as we talk about, maternal mortality and maternal depression. The governor's office is out with a couple of new proposals to deal with this. As you might have heard, New York State is 30th in the country. We're in the bottom half when it comes to maternal mortality. And as a country, we have one of the highest rates, if not the highest rate of maternal mortality in the developed world, and those numbers are going in the opposite direction that we'd like. So what's going on? The governor's office is proposing insurance has to cover maternal depression screening, and he wants to launch a new maternal mortality review board as part of his efforts to try to curb some of these issues. So let's get that only break of the hour, and we're right back to more of your calls and questions next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, a local filmmaker is hoping to engage Muslims and non-Muslims in conversations about racism and Islamophobia in America. Mara Ahmed has been outspoken about borders and nationalism. We'll discuss her work and her reactions to the Trump administration's policies on immigration and more. That's coming up Tuesday. Join the conversation on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Anne in Pittsburgh, next on the phone. Go ahead, Anne.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for this topic. It's, your panel is just wonderful. I'm calling in about mental health medication. I have a two-year-old now, but I was on mental health medication for mood stabilization. Fortunately, I had a wonderful psychiatrist, a wonderful primary care doctor, and a wonderful gynecologist. And they all, through the strong system, know what's going on because they can all see the same information. And I was very frequently, the blood tests and checking in and seeing how I was feeling. My fear, being around a lot of moms, especially new moms or pregnant moms, is that they're unwilling to admit that they're having these issues. I think that I feel based on my experience, that we're in a time right now where women are warriors. We got to be strong. We got to do it. And I'm fearful of that because I'm fortunate that I'm the kind of person that asks for help and asks questions, but it's not easy.
And thank you for that. What do you think, Dr. Richard?
It sounds like luckily you had a great communication and providers all in the same system and working toward that goal. I definitely hear what you're saying about having to be strong. I think even before now, even though now is probably a bigger time of woman empowerment, there's always that feeling of, you know, especially being pregnant, being the provider, you know, for your baby, that you have to sort of just handle everything. So I definitely hear what you're saying. I think what we can do is just educate people more about how common these things are, especially depression. I mean, depression, if I don't have it wrong, is the number one, you know, risk of childbirth, or I forget, you know, it's the number one poor outcome. It's the most common. So I think you're right, but we have to do better about sort of normalizing it in a way. And that's when I'm meeting with people, you know, this happens all the time. But we have a way to treat it and to make you better, whether it's just therapy or therapy and medications or just checking in. So,
And to be fair to the governor's office, I mentioned earlier, and I asked Dr. Richmond about her thoughts about the governor calling for mental health screenings to be covered by insurance for new moms. That's one thing. Now, in the bullet points that they list here, I'll also read this. The governor's directing the Office of Mental Health to advance cutting-edge specialty programs that treat maternal depression, including a mother-baby inpatient unit and outpatient programs that focus on maternal depression. Would you need to know more about that, or what do you think, Dr. Richmond?
I would love to have a mother-baby unit. There's only, I think, two right now. There's one at UNC Chapel Hill and one at Brown. A lot of the time when women come into the emergency room with very severe postpartum depression or postpartum psychosis, you know, a lot of the fear is they have to leave their baby. And so we admit them sometimes to our inpatient OBS unit. But those mother baby units have been really vital. And they're actually very common in Australia and England. They have a lot more, just to provide a safe environment where you can still, you know, care for your baby. I would love to have that. As well as, you know, these more special programs as far as outpatient mental health. But you also have to have providers trained. And this is such a special area. At Strong, we're one of the few who do it any sort of upstate New York. So we need obviously more education as well to be able to staff any of these programs that are proposed.
Probably requires some money.
Yes, it does.
All right. So, you know, to be clear, we'll see if the governor's office and the budget going forward includes the kind of funding to make that kind of program possible or at least more common. Mm-hmm. If it did, you could see maybe an even stronger impact than just more screenings?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's new drug on the market that is in development, which is actually an injection, an infusion over a few days that they've tested in a number of sites that sort of have more perinatal clinics for postpartum depression. It's SAGE something. And it's shown a lot of benefit quickly in women with postpartum depression. But you need a place to infuse it. You need a unit. Mm-hmm. You want to have the, you know, babies available to mom. So it's exciting that someone studied this, but we also need an infrastructure that can, you know, treat people.
All right, let's see going forward. Patrick in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Patrick.
Hi, Evan. So I'm a doula, I'm an acupuncturist, and I work with the University of Rochester. And I see as kind of a culture in this country a fear of physiologic birth, and that kind of triggering a lot of birth trauma, like you were talking about earlier, and that leading to a lot of postpartum depression. And I just wanted to have them discuss something about that. Obviously, we're not talking about high risk. We're talking about more the average mother. But that kind of fear and that culture away from the mother and the body kind of instinctually knowing what to do to some degree. I'll take my call. Yeah, thanks.
Patrick, thank you. Let me start with Lauren Deutsch, Executive Director of the Healthy Baby Network. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, that really is a strong culture. The trend in medicine is to really medicalize childbirth. And part of that has to do with, you know, the way doctors are trained, with the way, you know, insurance and liability drive healthcare practice. So there are protocols in every hospital when somebody comes in, how long it's really advisable to let them labor before you induce or before you go to a cesarean delivery, what level of sort of fetal distress will trigger certain medical interventions. A lot of that doesn't happen in a setting with less monitoring. And other countries that have sort of lower levels of cesarean delivery and frankly, better preventative health really don't do this to the same degree that we do. Our cesarean delivery rate is in the, you know, about 30% in the United States. And almost every other country that has socialized medicine, it's down around 10% or lower. So it's a lot of cesarean deliveries that are happening as a result of having sort of medicalized childbirth. You know, I think fear is a big driver. It's really scary to come into the hospital pregnant and have somebody say, what if you're, you know, if you don't do this, your kid's at risk? Or what happens if your kid is at risk? And we never, as Dr. Richmond said, you know, we never know with 100% certainty that that there's going to be a good outcome in any one case. So medicalizing really does seem safer. But when you start doing as many cesarean deliveries as we do, and you start having the amount of medical intervention that we have, you end up with complications, with this culture where we've increasingly medicalized childbirth, and you don't have as much natural delivery. So I think Patrick is absolutely right to be raising that issue.
Dr. Glantz, you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I have all kinds of thoughts on the matter. I would agree 100% with Patrick. I think a lot of women come into the labor and delivery experience not really sure what they're getting themselves in for. It's always hard to find a balance. I think I'm old enough to have lived through some of history. And one of those phases was the sort of the height of natural childbirth, where women were absolutely opposed to all interventions and they felt like a failure if they needed one. I sense we're kind of in the opposite field now, where a lot of women are expecting interventions and B, even demanding them. Not all women, absolutely. But I think we've sort of gone way too far to the other extreme. Also, the way these interventions are oftentimes put forth as well, if you want to do what's best for your baby, you'll be induced or you'll have your cesarean. What's not always said is, what actual benefit is going to come of this? Or is there even any evidence that there is any benefit? It might seem like a good idea, but that doesn't always mean that it really is going to do what you think it does. And then it traps the woman in a cycle where she doesn't want to take any chances with her baby, but now she feels out of control, and, you know, one thing leads to another. And then if things don't go exactly the way she maybe thought they would, then it's very disappointing, and that can lead to a depression as well.
Dr. Glantz, it's been a couple of years since we've had this conversation. But I want to say it was the American Academy of Pediatrics that came out with a call to reduce the number of C-sections in this country from 30 to 33%, roughly a third or right around there, thinking maybe we can cut that in half realistically. Is that, am I remembering correctly?
The World Health Organization, World Health Organization has set a 15% rate as what seems reasonable. The problem is no one knows really what the right rate is.
But is 30, 33% like we have here too high?
I believe it is. I believe we're not really getting much benefit for the number of cesareans we're doing.
Okay. So again, my memory is sometimes faulty, but again, what you just heard from Lauren Deutsch is essentially correct. That a lot of other countries have a lot lower rates of C-section, and I know there are other countries with higher rates. I think Brazil has the highest rate in the world, and different places have different cultures, as Patrick said, but there is definitely a call to reduce that in this country. So Patrick, thank you for the phone call. I want to grab Victoria in Rochester next. Go ahead, Victoria.
Hi. So I was listening to this and I was kind of thinking about it. I'm an IVF patient, and I kind of, dare I say, like, nobody knows that we're going to get pregnant more than us who are going through IVF. And I can't help but think that there has been no health screening or mental health screening for me or any of the women that I'm aware of, really. Nothing offered by, like, a reproductive endocrinologist or anything of this sort. Is anything going to change there? Is this an area that will be getting more attention?
It's interesting because I know at certain IVF clinics there is more screening, because I actually get a lot of referrals, because, as you know better than anyone, the whole just going through that process can cause a lot of anxiety and depression. I'm not sure about if the governor's, you know, mandate would include that. It makes sense to me that it would, because again, the outcome is hopefully pregnancy and then going forward. But you're right, just people with IVF and going through that in general have a higher, you know, higher rate of either anxiety or depression. So it makes sense.
Go ahead, Doctor.
The medical screening as well would be key. In fact, I know I have occasionally done preconception counseling visits. Patients referred to me from the reproductive endocrinologist because they do have multiple medical problems, and we want to make sure they know what they're getting themselves into.
All right. Here's a question from Tim in Pittsburgh. He says, it would seem that a lot of our health issues can be linked to modern-day diets. Not all, and not for everyone, of course. But do the doctors think that troubled childbirth outcomes could be helped by wholesale changes in diet to include a shift toward a plant-based diet? That's from Tim. Dr. Glantz?
I wish it were that simple. I would have to say that our diet certainly could be improved, but I don't think that's the underlying factor. How they might be related to obesity would certainly be a step in the right direction, and a lot to be said for plant-based diets. I'm not a vegetarian, but I like my vegetables.
Okay. Dr. Richman?
Yeah, I would agree exactly what Dr. Glantz said. And as far as depression, there's no nutritional, you know, treatment that I know of or preventative measure. But of course, a good diet can help in general, just overall health. So,
all right. So as we get ready to close the program with a lot of emphasis on improving outcomes for mothers, and in particular, reducing maternal death, I'm going to go around the table and just ask for some final thoughts as we go forward. We're going to see if the governor and New York State sort of back some of their proposals with funding to help in various ways. But Lauren Deutsch is the executive director of the Healthy Baby Network. What do you think is number one on the list going forward, which would improve the outcomes for moms and to frankly change our standing worldwide as leading in a category no one wants to lead, maternal mortality in developed nations?
Honestly, poverty. We need to deal with systemic intergenerational poverty and the gendered way in which poverty impacts women. In the Rochester area, 8 out of 10 custodial parents are women. Single women raising children are the largest single demographic in Rochester, who are living in extreme poverty. We're first in the nation in extreme child poverty. And all of the risk factors that go along with poverty are impacting all the parts of health that don't happen at the doctor's office. Before a woman even gets pregnant, she's at greater risk for trauma, for stress, exposure to violence, exposure to substance abuse, for domestic violence, for housing insecurity, food instability, all of the factors that contribute to whether or not she's able to get to care,
have a healthy pregnancy, follow up on treatment recommendations from a physician, have a good relationship with a physician whom she trusts and can see repeatedly instead of getting sort of emergency-based care. So I think the number one thing that we can do is anti-poverty work.
All right, 30 seconds apiece. Dr. Glantz, go ahead.
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress. There's what's called the Safe Motherhood Initiative, which I've been a part for a number of years, that was put forth by the American College. And that's been looking at some of the more preventable causes of death, hypertension, hemorrhage, and blood clots. And I think we've made a lot of progress in educating people on how to address these. The other thing is the Maternal Mortality Review Board that I'm a part of, and that is an attempt to, rather than just look at death certificates, which honestly don't give you a whole lot of detail about what was going on, to look underneath these and see what were the underlying issues. Were they social? Were they medical? Did the patient come for care? Did she not come for care? Did she go for the wrong place? Was it a problem that was so severe we can't do anything about it? Or was it a problem that maybe we could have done something about? And then we know where to focus our efforts and work on continuing to lower the mortality rate.
All right, Dr. Richman, keep it tight. Go ahead.
I would say the screening is a good start, but also then having something set up where we actually treat people and also educating providers in a way that, you know, they feel more comfortable and normalizing it, that depression happens very commonly in pregnancy and that's okay and we can treat it so that you can be the best you can for your baby.
And Heather Bryant's doing well. We're glad to hear that. Some
Thank
final
you.
Thoughts from you on what you learned in the process.
I agree with the screenings. If there's some follow-through, you know, you would think you'd eventually decrease some of the issues.
You mentioned the two of the worst weeks of your life, but I'm really glad to hear that not only you came through that, but you had a wonderful doctor and the system helped you. And
very much.
Now the goal is for access for everyone. And I go back to what Lauren Deutsch said. I mean, just making sure that this incredible healthcare system we have really is accessible for everyone, no matter what your income level, no matter what your background is. That's part of the goal. Our thanks to Heather Bryant. Good luck to you and your
thank
family.
You.
Thanks
thank
for being
you.
Here. Dr. Chris Glantz, thank you, doctor.
Oh, you're very well.
Dr. Jennifer Richman, thank you, doctor.
Thank you.
And Lauren Deutsch, executive director of the Healthy Baby Network.
Thank you
for being here.
Thank you so
here.
Much.
Tim George, engineer. Thank you, Tim. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we'll be back with you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.